Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Our election roundup conversation will conclude with questions from the audience. This panel was moderated by Morning Edition host Zach Bernard, and the first question will be answered by Professor Mike Wolf from Purdue Fort Wayne. Please enjoy the discussion.
We have a question from Facebook from Jennifer Purdue. Thank you, Jennifer, for that question. This one's directed towards Mike or Brian. Are there any current elected representatives that are focused on bringing jobs to the state that focus on telecommuting? Also, are there any of the current or past representatives responsible for bringing IU Health to town?
I'm being very cautious about the IU Healthcare and IU and Purdue University right now, so I'm going to hold off on this. I think that that's one of my former students who is an excellent student. I can't tell you how excellent because she has federal violations against me talking about it. But I think what she's pointing to, though, is what are we doing about maybe cutting-edge technology and cutting-edge jobs? And so I think we should be thinking about that. Like, so where is Fort Wayne situated in attracting, and where are our politicians pushing on attracting the businesses of so-called the future? So,
yeah, and a lot of that's also going to be driven by educational attainment levels. So what we know is that the new jobs that have been created in the state of Indiana since the year 2000 have gone to people with college degrees, with bachelor's degrees or higher. So the jobs that you're seeing that are coming, that are open now, that are perceived as new jobs, are really just replacing manufacturing jobs, skilled trade jobs that may have been scaled back, let's say, during the Great Recession or in the early 2000s when we were having a lot of automation and jobs being transferred to other countries. So you're looking at that. So really the job growth in the state of Indiana has been, for those with college degrees, it has actually been in central Indiana. Indianapolis has been doing very nicely for themselves in job growth. So that's been a challenge. And so that's a question, is how do we put that mix together? Because when I bring this up, the first response I get back is, well, we need skilled tradespeople. And I don't disagree with that, but those are often because folks are leaving the job market. So that means that they have decided to either leave their occupation, they are retiring, those sorts of things. So it's not actually a new job. It's the fact that it is a replacement for somebody who is leaving.
Yeah, and I would just like to say that the studies by the American Association of State Colleges and Universities say you need universities that put out people with all levels of job skills, including the liberal arts. And we are, in the past few years, have a large-scale debate, partly because of the IU and Purdue situation. And we are over-determining the kind of jobs that we're looking at for the reasons you're talking about, and forgetting you need to invest in Purdue University Fort Wayne. And we should push our state to continue to do so. And every other public university, by the way, and public education generally, because that's where the jobs are going to come.
If we might circle back around to a potential difference between between Arizona and Indiana. I was in Arizona in December, and a number of organizers working on the ground there to mobilize the ground game. And as somebody who's lived in Northeast Indiana since 2001, I've seen ground organizing for issues such as RFRA, HDR3. I haven't seen it translate to general campaigns. Do you have any thoughts on why we don't see that here, as opposed to other states, even conservative states like in Arizona, where we do see an active ground game engaging in these campaigns?
A lot of those ground games are inspired by Washington groups, both liberal and conservative. And in Indiana this year, I really saw very little involvement by national or state Democrats in Joe Donnelly's campaign. Well, the state Democrats in Joe Donnelly's campaign, but Courtney Trich's campaign. Joe Donnelly claimed to have a good grassroots movement. Courtney Trich did the same. But there were congressional candidates on the Democratic side from around the state that were just getting no help whatsoever from groups that could help them organize, that could do telephone banks, that could do door hangers. I think a lot of the congressional Democratic candidates were just kind of hung out to dry so that they could put more effort behind Donnelly. So I think the grassroots, you know, you can call it grassroots, but usually you've got a pretty organized Washington-based advocacy group that's teaching them how to do it.
Well, the ground game is, you know, we spend a lot of attention on how much ads are and how many ads there are, but the demonstrated point that's for the last 20 years that we have particularly learned is that the door knocking and the targeting of voters, the use of big data to know what doors to knock on, is extraordinary. It outbeats any other investment out there. So your point is very solid. And in some of the, actually in some of the municipal, the mayoral election, for instance, we've seen a little bit more of that, ironically, relative to some of these more federal races. So I think we'll see more of that, interestingly, next year in some of these components of like what Brian was talking about, that because the investment needs to be there. But it is extraordinary the kind of the benefits you get. But the one thing that is missing is we have big data on people. We know who standard Democrats are and Republicans, particularly of a particular age. We don't know who the millennials support. They have different issue packages that they're interested in. And nobody has gone out and asked them to vote for us. You go vote for me, because you're afraid of mobilizing them on the other side. And it's a major factor that's going to come due soon, that bill's going to come due. Because you don't get people to turn out to vote unless you ask them to vote for you. And someone's got to figure out where they are on issues and how to mobilize them. They aren't very partisan. They haven't liked politics because they've grown up when it's, you know, this negative crap. And so I think that the next learning curve in American politics is learning how to ask them and approach them in a realistic way to mobilize them.
I just want to thank you guys for your time up there and your expertise. I believe I had a class with you, Professor Wolf, so appreciate you. So I'm a recovering Democratic candidate from District 81 and also a public school teacher who teaches government. So I'm getting dinged twice. But I guess my question is, you know, what kind of a recession would it take for a Democrat to win in Indiana? Because given the studies of precincts in 2008, 2012, 2016, it looks like things have been pretty hardwired for Republicans via gerrymandering, very kind of party ID has hardened. And I think a lot of the brain drain has gone to mostly liberal states where people can earn higher wages. So I guess, what is it going to take for Indiana to elect Democrats at this stage of the game?
It's going to take big city Democrats moving back to states like Indiana. I think they're saying that something like 30% of the population controls 70% of the U.S. Senate, that they, you know, because you have two U.S. senators for every state, that states like, you know, North and South Dakota and Montana have just as much representation in the Senate as New York and California. And a lot of people have been saying if there's going to be a real blue wave, it's going to take young Democrats moving from the city to rural areas. And there do not seem to be any signs of that happening anytime soon.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for teaching. Thanks for taking my class. But also, thanks for running for office, because this is, you don't, if you don't run for office, you don't, you know, if you don't mobilize people, you don't get it. I mean, one of the issues to Brian's point is kind of ancillary point, but we haven't changed the size of the U.S. House of Representatives in 100 years. And as a result, you have this situation where you can be in Wyoming and maybe have 500,000 people, and in our congressional district, who are, you know, packing it at 750,000 plus, and it gives an unweighted advantage to small states. And we can fix that. And we'll, by the way, it would blow away gerrymandering, because it would be hard to draw districts in a smaller, we'd have more representation. India has a better constituent to representative ratio than we do in the U.S. House of Representatives. It is no good reason why we don't do it except for kind of just keeping our own current thing. And by the way, it's not very popular to say what we need is more politicians in Washington, you know. So, but if you want to fix the Electoral College map, you want to fix representation in the United States, the fact that you have to raise all the money that Brian was talking about earlier, make these districts reasonably sized, that they people know their representatives, that you can mobilize people. You'd have pockets of areas where we'd have competitive elections where we don't now. And so that's not a constitutional amendment. That's just the U.S. House of Representatives changing how it does things.
Our microphone didn't pick it up, but an audience member just asked how the census can affect the representation in the U.S. House. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, but they haven't added the number. So in George Washington, the last thing he said in the Constitutional Convention, by the way, was I want one representative for every 30,000 people. It was the First Amendment to the Constitution, never got ratified. So that's how important they, because they were afraid of a big republic, that it would fail. Rome failed because it got too big. So we should have one representative for every 30,000 people. So if it's good for George Washington, it's good for me. But at some point, you get in an industrialized age, right around 1910, 1912, they didn't increase it, right? And the country was growing fast, and we got all these immigrants that came in. And so there you go. And so if you look at it, the last time we did it was the same time that we got Fenway and all these things. And if you they've modernized that since then, right, and made it a good place to go. Same with Wrigley Field. Let's modernize this and make it right again.
Okay, so in the sense of like honoring the full disclosure, I actually just got done spending the summer in D.C. working on the Farm Bill on Capitol Hill. So I had a bit of full immersion, which is why I was asking the question that I did. And in that sense, having had the privilege of meeting people like Dr. Eichert and Phil Hoffner, who've been working on these issues for probably longer than I've been alive, and getting a chance to sit down and talk with them, one of the things that's really struck me really hard is the fact that pretty much prior to when I was here, back when we had different people representing us in a federal context, things like food were less partisan, because I'm pretty sure, regardless of what anyone in this room believes, we've all eaten in the last 24 hours and we'll do again in the next 24 hours. And there was a time when food and agriculture was a lot less partisan. And one of my biggest takeaways from my time in DC was the sense that the people who've been working on this for longer than anyone else have a deep, deep, deep sense of unease and fear and concern, because our food and agriculture has become extremely partisan, and they're holding things hostage over things like increased work requirements for SNAP, which is such a touchstone thing, but it's not the entire thing that Farm Bill is. It's a big chunk of the money, but there's a lot of other issues to it, and we've gotten hung up on all these partisan issues. And what can we do? Like, what are your thoughts on the fact that we've turned a basic right and necessity, like food and agriculture, into a partisan politic game? And people are polarizing around, you know, minuscule differences when we all are pretty much at the same table and we have the same thing to lose.
I think it's an excellent point. I used to talk to my Congress class and say, and we had Representative Stutzman in, and he was on the Financial Services Committee and the Agricultural Committee, and trying to tell these students how different a partisan committee is from the Agricultural Committee. He wasn't there that long ago, and he'd say, oh, the Agricultural Committee is so much fun. Everyone agrees. It's a nonpartisan. We get along. Everyone wants to just increase subsidy. Whatever else. And we've even made that one partisan. So that's where we are. So what you are seeing is this is where we are. We are in a lockdown, you know, very difficult period. That it's not even fun teaching half these classes anymore because of where we're at. You can't demonstrate how politics can work across party lines sufficiently. So your example is exactly right about just how public policy is in a cul-de-sac, that the only way out is one of the parties completely getting crushed at some point, which is never a comfortable place in American history.
Before we kind of close up shop here, before we get going, would the three of you like to, you know, leave us with any closing remarks?
Well, I'd say go vote in the next election, but we're doing a pretty good job of it now. Just keep informed about the issues and the candidates, and if you don't like the way Indiana is electing its candidates, you're going to have to move to a new state, I guess.
Since CRI is nonpartisan, we don't comment on elections, but I will say that what I think is always challenging is for people to recognize that whatever today's conditions are not going to be what tomorrow's economic conditions are. I remember when we were going through the Great Recession and unemployment was heading towards the double digits, and we thought, could we ever have full employment again? And we did, and we've been below 5% for a few years now. So I think it's now hard for us to recognize that we could ever have a time where the jobs will not be outnumbered by the people. And so it's just going to be interesting to watch where this goes cyclically and where what forces come in play in the next few years.
I'd just like to say, on a positive side, that we live in an area, for one, which has great media. I mean, to sit here with Brian and see here at this radio station, we are incredibly lucky for the information that we get and the quality of it in this area. And we shouldn't ever fail that we also have some great private universities, public universities, and other things. But these are things that can go away quickly. And so invest in local media, invest in the information sources we have for our community to be fully informed.
Brian Francisco, Rachel Blakeman, and Mike Wolf, thank you so much for your participation on this panel this evening.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Greg Case for running sound at Joseph DeQuise. Next week, we will bring you our news roundup for the month of November. Our theme music is by Mark Waldick. Additional music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Have a wonderful day.